Welcome to another episode of G220 Radio. I'm Ricky Gantz along with Mike Miller, and we are G220 Radio. This is episode number 438. So episode number 438, we've got a good program for you tonight, and I hope you will stick around, share the program. If you got any feedback, we'd love to hear from you. G220Radio at gmail.com. You can follow us on Podbean, iTunes. Well, it's not iTunes anymore. It's Apple, Stitcher, any of the podcast catchers. You can listen to the programs afterwards, but you can watch us live here on YouTube. And so we hope you would go and subscribe to that. Mike, episode number 438, still confessing. How are you doing, brother?
Doing pretty good and really excited to have our guest with us. He has been at times a soundboard for me as preparing for podcasts, though he moved away, so not as much more recently with it. But I think it's a good conversation and just going through this book into how can Reformed Baptists ascribe to the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. I think it sometimes is a topic, either you have to do one or the other. And I think what we'll see here in this book that we're talking about it with our guest, that you can hold to both. And be, I guess, geared towards the Southern Baptist, but be a faithful Southern Baptist and hold to both of them and their effects on Baptist life. So, you have anything to say, Ricky?
No, I'm looking forward to it. As you know, like I've been in a few Southern Baptist churches as a Reformed 1689 Baptist, and so I really don't know as much about the way some of the things work within the SBC. Let me just check something here. But I am looking forward to this conversation because as a 1689, someone who holds to the 1689, reading through the Baptist Faith and Message, there are some things that come up that, you know, questions that you would have. But I didn't see anything that would ultimately say, well, no, I couldn't affirm these things. I think there is some questions that you would have to kind of maybe get some clarity on and understanding, and hopefully we could do some of that here tonight. But for the most part, that's always been my impression with the Baptist Faith and Message was it was because within the SBC, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong on this, you have a diversity within the Baptist churches that you have. You may have those who are more covenantal and opposed to those maybe more dispensational or Calvinistic and non-Calvinistic and so forth. And so therefore, you're going to have those differences where with the BFM, you can maybe find common ground. Whereas me coming from a 1689 perspective, looking at it being pretty detailed in that. So I'm interested in looking at what our guest here has to say about this in the book. And I do plan on getting the book. Mike threw that at me earlier. Plan on getting the book. And matter of fact, I think we're going to give one away, too. And so we will let you know. Listen to this program. Share this program. Mike and I will come up with an idea of how we will decide who would be the winner of that. And we'll give away a book, Still Confessing. So go ahead, Mike.
To introduce our guest, he is a husband. He is a father. He has four kids and wonderful kids, though sometimes annoying to teach because they're well discipled. And so they tend to answer the questions right. He's a pastor at Long Plain Baptist Church in Acushnet, Massachusetts. He was an elder at Cosmosdale. That's how I got to know him. And he has a bachelor's from Boyce College. His MDiv is from Southern, and he's currently working on his PhD at Southern. He's written a couple articles We have it, but what we're going to talk about is his book, Still Confessing. Get out of the light there. Welcome to the show, Daniel Scheider.
Thank you.
So, I know I got to listen to this book.
You cheated. Oh, I thought you was going to say Audible.
No. It was Audible from Daniel's mouth.
Yeah.
As a Sunday school. And so I've been excited about this book for over a year as founders kind of kept not releasing it, since I've known about it. So kind of the first question, kind of look into it. Why did you feel a need to kind of write an exposition and not a critique, as some may have thought early on, of the Baptist faith and message?
Yeah, that's a good question. And thank you guys for having me on the podcast, on the show, to talk about the book. So why write an exposition? Why not write a critique? There are a couple reasons. One would be, why not write a critique? I think there are reasons to critique the BFM, and those would have to do with things that Ricky was saying earlier, in terms of the fact that it doesn't have the kind of depth of language that the 1689 has, and I think everybody can be as honest as should be as honest as they can about that. The fact that it is a broader confession meant to bring in more people means that there are going to be more points where we can quibble with the way things are said, and especially if you're trying to bring Calvinists and those that are less Calvinist together, and plenty of people can critique it and should, and that's fine. When you put out a confession, you're saying this is what we believe, right? And so you're opening yourself to critique, and so we should be willing to do so as well. My goal wasn't to do that, because of the fact that what I was aiming at is to show how a Calvinist, a red-blooded 1689 Calvinist, whether certain people would like us to call ourselves Reformed or not, is a different issue, right? But whether, how is it that 1689 guys hold to the BFM 2000? And so my goal was to say, here's how we understand these words, how we take these doctrines, and how we don't see them really as a threat to what we believe. We obviously believe things, we believe more. Everybody believes more than any confession says. But we don't believe less than the things that are stated here. And so here's how we would understand this. So that would be one reason. Another within that idea is, there really isn't an exposition from the exclusively Calvinist wing of the SBC. You have a Sunday school sort of study guide that was done by Dr. Moeller and others, but that really was meant to give a full orbed voice to it, and so it's not as explicit on things that we would want to be explicit on. So it's fine, it's a good resource, but it's not as explicitly on the Reformed end of the SBC as we would like. And so if I'm a 1689 pastor in the SBC wanting to hand out a book, the goal was, this could be that book that somebody could hand out and say, here's how we're a part of the SBC, and yet we hold to something a little more substantial as well.
Now,
One
of the things, we've done a series on the 1689 that we're still kind of going through by chapters. And maybe for someone who's tuning into this program, because we're mentioning confessions, we're talking about the Baptist Faith and Message, a 2000 Confession of Faith. Mm-hmm. Maybe for this, if they're tuning in and they haven't listened to one of those programs, because we have talked about the importance of confessions, why would a confession be important? Maybe just laying that out to them to put some groundwork there as well.
Yeah. So, so I think I lay out three reasons in the book in terms of what you might use a confession for. First, a confession says internally who we are. So who you need, what you need to believe to be part of us, whoever the us are, right? So you can go back to the early creeds and say, what does it mean to be part of, you know, to confess the Catholic faith? It would mean to be able to affirm the Nicene Creed and the fact that the Son is the only begotten of the Father, and yet he's begotten, not made, and one essence, and all the rest. And then as you move into the Reformation era, you have the same thing. You have the idea of confessions marking out who we are in distinction from Rome, and distinction from Lutherans. And then over in Britain, you have the same thing, distinguishing who we are. So if you're part of the Congregationalists, if you're part of this group of Baptists, and this is what you would hold to. And so this does the same thing. It marks kind of those boundary markers in terms of who we're letting into our group, whatever that group is. You might have, and I would say that you probably should have a more explicit confession for a local church. And then you might have a broader confession to allow for churches that might differ on various things, depending on the level of that. So that's one reason. The second reason would be to tell the outside world. So one is to tell, to mark the boundaries of who's within us. And then that also tells the outside world, here's what this group believes. So we can hold up the Baptist faith message, for instance, and say, here's what we believe on sexuality. Here's what we believe on gender roles and on the family and things like that. This whole group of Christians believe these things, mm-hmm. on these things. And so it serves an apologetic purpose. It serves a boundary marker purpose. And then the third, and this is explicitly stated in the 1689 in the letter to the reader, is for discipleship purposes, which is kind of the goal of the book, right? Mm-hmm. Is to take the confession and let it guide you through the discipleship process, especially as I, as a pastor, would sit down with a new believer and say, okay, let's just talk about all the various things that Christians believe. And so it serves a catechetical purpose. So an apologetic purpose, a boundary purpose, and a catechetical purpose like that.
Yeah. So we've been talking about the Second London 1689 Confession and the Baptist Faith and Message. Can you just give us a quick history of like on each and how they are related? Because they're not two kind of distinct confessions.
Yeah. Yeah, that's I did that in the Sunday school, right? So we went through the opening. You'll notice in the introduction, if you read the book, in the introduction, I sort of do a big broad brush sweep through church history to say how we ended up with this. And so I'll try to do that even shorter here. And I know everybody's eyes were big and yeah, everybody's out of breath by the end of the Sunday school hour. But okay, so the 1689 comes about technically in 1677. As a revision of the Savoy Declaration, according to the principles that were articulated in the First London Baptist Confession of Faith. So you have this First London Baptist Confession of Faith in 1644 and was revised in 1646 during the Westminster Assembly. While the Westminster Divines come out with the Westminster Confession of Faith, the Congregationalists, Westminster is Presbyterian, Congregationalists, especially John Owen, modify it according to Congregationalist principles, and then Baptists modify that according to the Credo Baptistic Congregational principles. So I think Matthew Bingham is correct to say. So Matthew Bingham has a book called Orthodox Radicals, where he explains that the Baptist really should be understood as a almost like a subcategory of Congregationalists. And so we're a group of Congregationalists, at least the ones that we would want to go back to. And so they take that Congregationalist confession, revise it in 1677. They're not able to affix their names to it because of persecution at the time as nonconformists and dissenters. And then finally, they are able to in 1688 and then later as well. In 1689, there's a massive General Assembly. The confession isn't actually part of that at all, except for the fact that the assembly is made up of churches that all held to that confession as their original confession. So that would be the 1689. Well, the 1689 comes over to the United States, and especially under the influence of Elias Keach, whose father had signed the 1689 or been part of the 1689 assembly. Elias comes over, they establish the Philadelphia Baptist Association, which adopts the 1689 and includes two other chapters that were common in the Keach circles, the practices of laying on of hands and singing psalms, singing man-made hymns. But other than that, it's identical to the 1689. That association plants another association in the South, a church, and that grows into an association in the South, the Charleston Association. They also adopt the confession. And so you can say very confidently that the original Baptists, the main Baptists in America, were all subscribers to the 1689. But then you also have the Great Awakenings, and you have various things that happen there. And eventually you have issues of hyper-Calvinism and all these things. And so a pastor up in New Hampshire draws up a confession called the New Hampshire Confession of Faith in 1833. And then it's received by the New Hampshire Association in 1854. That confession is used to draft up the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. So everybody holds to the 1689 going into this, but there are movements. And so by the time you get to the 20th century, you have all sorts of movements. Anybody that studies theology in the 19th century cannot come away thinking it's very monolithic. There are so many different movements, and you can even think of like the radical things like the cults, right? Mormonism and all of that. You can think of the fact that the Enlightenment has taken full root and liberalism has taken full root, and you have there's a reason why we look back to old Princeton as the great pillar of the truth at that time, is because the world was sinking in all sorts of issues during that time as well. Well, in light of that, and in light of the fundamentalist and modernist controversy that was gripping every group of Christians, the Southern Baptists and the Northern Baptists wanted to draw up a confession of faith that they could both hold to in light of all of this opposition. So how do we hold the ground on orthodoxy in light of all the opposition that's arisen? Tom Nettles has written a short blog post on this in on Founders. It's the 1925 Baptist Faith and Message, a rock in a storm, or something along those lines, where he explains that E.Y. Mullins and so the Southern Baptists and the Northern Baptists wanted to draw up this confession that would unite the two against modernism, and so Mullins decides to use the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. Why not? We agree with it. It's Northern, and so it shows a sense of deference, right, from the Southerners, and the Northern Baptists actually didn't like it, or didn't like the denominational aspect of it. They wanted a little more of the autonomy, and so they ended up not adopting it. But the Southern Baptists did, as this, as the 1925 Baptist Faith and Message. And then, of course, you have more movements that bring about another revision in 1963, and then finally the conservative resurgence, the great conservative resurgence that we'll hopefully look back on as something of a stake in the ground for orthodoxy that resulted in the Baptist Faith Message 2000. So you do see it's connected. There's a lot of development that you have to take into account. I hope I covered everything sufficiently in a very brief time.
Yeah, and to add on, and obviously you know this, that even the entities in the SBC still hold more closely to the 1689. Southern Seminary, Southeastern, both adopt the abstract of principles, which is abstract of the 1689, back before made when Southern was created back in the
1858.
And so you don't have the Baptist Faith and Messages already. So, you know, even the connection is more solid in a way. And I think having that background helps us to also understand that these confessions speak on issues of their times. You've kind of brought it out a little bit. And so there's even, you're talking about exposition of Baptist Faith and Message coming from a 1689 perspective. But not everything in the 1689 is in the BFM and vice versa.
I think that's it's important to see that too. The fact that the SBC was founded by several churches that all would have held to the 1689 as their local confession, or their local association would have held to that confession, or something along those lines. As I mentioned, Charleston. So whether you're in the North or the South, the 1689 would have been your sort of seedbed out of which your theology grew. And then so that by the time you need to drop an abstract to lead your school, well, what else are you going to abstract your theology from but the obvious confession of faith that we all hold to. And there's really no need for another confession while everybody's holding to that one in the South at the time, right? It's not until these other issues are showing up and there's this confluence of political issues that we see the need for a new confession to come out. And you can't forget too that there was the rise of dispensationalism. I mentioned all these various movements that show up in the 19th century, and dispensationalism is one of those. So that as so if I were to imagine the SBC adopting something more explicitly Calvinistic and covenantal by the end of the 20th century, that just, it's not really imaginable, because dispensationalism had taken so much root in Baptist circles, especially. So, I don't know how much we could go back to Calvinism, but at least it's open. We're allowed in.
Yeah, and you know, as you mentioned, kind of earlier in the show, you see kind of it open up more as these various movements that maybe we not agree with, and maybe think they're interpreting scripture wrong, like dispensationalism. Right. It doesn't make them less of a Christian, but that might be different. Obviously, you mentioned in the book, Cosmas Tale, where as a member, I can join and hold to the BFM 2000. But if I was ever to be called to be an elder there, I have to subscribe to the 1689. And now there's maybe people who disagree having two confessions, depending on where you are. But with it, you still, you know, it's important to know it with it. And I think that's what makes this book a resource. Even thinking about listening to it in Sunday school and kind of with it is that, yeah, I may not agree with dispensationalism, but that doesn't mean I can, you know, I can throw out the BFM. I could still be a part of it and in good keeping without reservations. I might have to clarify or nuance things because they might want to have it open to include others, but that, you know, I can still say, yeah, this is a confession I can hold to, and I could be a member of a church that if they teach it, I could hold to, though we may have minor differences.
Yeah. Yeah. Minor or even major, right? I mean, dispensationalism is a major difference. And yet exactly. We're one of the things that I think is beneficial about something like the SBC for a Reformed Baptist. So like, why would a Reformed Baptist be part of the SBC? I think if as Baptists want to engage in evangelical conversations, just conversations at the bigger evangelical world, being part of the SBC kind of opens that up for you to where you can be having conversations with gusto, with those that disagree with you on the doctrine of election, those that disagree with you on the relationship between Israel and the church and these things. And yet you still have a place at the table because technically 1689 is not out of bounds. And so there's the benefit of that. I think local churches should probably have something stricter for their local church, at least for the teaching office. But the BFM is wide enough that it allows the bigger voices for that inter-church work and conversation.
Well, I know even that in the 1689 churches that don't necessarily hold to, you know, they're not Southern Baptist, they don't hold to BFM 2000, even in them, many of them would say you can be a member of the church without ascribing exactly to everything in the 1689. But again, as Mike was saying there, but if you wanted to teach or you was in one of those types of positions, a leadership position, you would not be able to if you did not affirm everything within the confession.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think one of the benefits, this happened while I was actually, I think it was in the same business meeting that I was voted in as a deacon at Cosmosdale, the adoption of the BFM as an official subscriptional document for Cosmosdale happened. And the idea was consistency in teaching with the 1689, but also having a sort of, you can't affirm homosexuality or you can't affirm certain abortion or something like that and be a member either. Mm-hmm. And so what that allows is a lower, say a lower bar to be a member while there's still being a bar, right? You still have to affirm basic Baptist Christianity. But to teach, you have to teach in accordance with the 1689, and so that allows for some consistency in teaching while also giving clarity for membership even.
Yeah.
So about the book and the layout, yeah. I do really enjoy the layout. Obviously, this is how you taught it, so it makes it there where you kind of walk through it a little bit, explaining it. You give some exposition of it. You use the proof texts or some of the proof texts the BFM gets, making a note that proof texts are the clear parts of scripture which prove it, but we'll still with the understanding they need to be interpreted correctly.
Right.
But also give additional resources. I think that helps even clarifying when we'll get into Article 2 of the BFM, but that you can go, okay, so here's what the BFM says, but here are kind of the chapters, if applicable, in the London Confession. So you can read it yourself, and other, you provide, I think, the Nicene Creed is in part of it too. I think just for that, to say, okay, here's some other, like, part of it to connect, to say we're, you know, your BFM is not disconnecting from broader Christianity with it, but to also further study. You linked other books and articles too that help flesh some of this out more in it. And I think that in itself is also very valuable in this book. I know I have the book list and a paper, you know, 8.5 by 11 paper on that. So just explain a little bit why you kind of chose this way as opposed to maybe more integrated or in other ways that you could present this.
Yeah. So, so I mentioned a while ago about the fact that confessions can be used catechetically, right? And that's sort of the idea behind this. So I'm hoping that by teaching my children the Keach's Catechism, say, teaching my children Keach's Catechism, they're going to have the basic vocabulary to be able then to, as they grow and as they grow in their knowledge, as they grow in just in wisdom and mentally, that they would be able to step into the next stage of theological reading, that they would be able to pick up something more substantial, maybe Dag or finally Gill, somebody wonderful, right? And so that's sort of the idea behind this as well, is I want to give a very concise explanation, and I did place myself under strict limits. I had word limits that I wanted to stay within for the exposition and then for the biblical text as well. And I really aimed to stay within that. And it did make me want to write a systematic where I could be more free and explain in sufficient detail, because none of this is in sufficient detail, but it is in introductory detail. And so the idea is this is a step into the realm of theology. And in my conclusion, I say this isn't supposed to be like, okay, now I know what theology is. This is supposed to whet your appetite, give you the basic lay of the land, and allow you to now move into something more explicit. And so here, and then going to the resource list, here are places you might go. You might go to a more substantial explanation of the doctrine of the church, the doctrine of whatever in the London, or you can go to this book and see a more robust treatment of this doctrine. So that, I had another thought, but I lost it. I was thinking of it like this. So we were talking about how all of us were in the military. We're all veterans, and in the Army, you go into basic training, right? And the idea behind basic training, so you show up and you're this big soldier, and you get to fire the 50 cal, and you get to fire the all these things, right? But and they keep calling it familiarization, and you have no idea what that means. You just know you get to blow stuff up and shoot targets, and it's all fun and games. And then you get to your unit, and you find out that, yeah, there's a lot more to know about all of those weapon systems than you learned in basic training. And so familiarization meant I was supposed to be familiar with it. I've had my hands on it. I felt the recoil, and so I can dig deeper now and know my weapon system better if I'm placed on it. And so you might say this is like familiarization for theology. It gives you hands-on testing of all sorts of doctrines, all sorts of issues that Christians have to think about, and then hopefully it is a helpful step so that you know what you're looking at when you dig into a thicker book, that a book length treatment on any of these things.
Maybe you should wait for a an upcoming systematic come out, edited it into more of a Baptist covenant theology.
There we go. There we go.
It's an inside joke about his PhD.
Yes.
Thing. So let's move in. Let's just cover here. Come up quickly. Three articles that we've selected. We're going to do article two on God. Mainly going to just kind of do it so we can see similarities, something maybe a little bit more closer in line with the 1689. And then we're going to look at article eight on the Lord's Day, which probably has is a bigger gap between the two. And especially with it. And then also look at article 12 education, just to see, because it's not in the 1689.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about why a little bit, although we've kind of covered it already. So we'll look at the doctrine of God. Now you cover it in two chapters, because the BFM covers it all three persons in one article, which is a lot, because there's a lot to be said about each person and also their unity as one. You know, because as Christians, we're Trinitarian, and the Baptist faith and message also talks about it. So kind of, you know, as someone in 1689, what were some of kind of your thoughts when you kind of first read, when you're kind of studying through what the BFM authors were trying to convey? Because one, we could probably say with that there is a departure from maybe classical theism, which, you know, 1689 is more hold to with that.
Yeah. So that's... So it's interesting because what you do have is a different, it's different enough in the way that it's expressing itself, that it's hard to immediately understand everything that they're trying to do. And I really like reading the Scholastics. And so it is a different way of seeing this expressed. One thing that I really, as I'm looking at it, there are a few things that they say that are particularly helpful that wouldn't have been an issue in the 1689, in the time of 1689, not as much of an issue. They are an issue, but not as much of an issue. So in the middle of the introductory paragraph of the article, it says God is all-powerful and all-knowing, and his perfect knowledge extends to all things past, present, and future, including the future decisions of his free creatures, And the idea there is, if you look at the various editions of that, that is an expansion on what was said. And when you think of when this came out, it came out in 2000, and what's going on in the 90s and into the 2000s, and really, of course, you can go further back, is the advent of open theism, right? Mm-hmm. And open theism with its expression that God knows all things past and present. But in order for man to be actually free, for his decisions to truly have an either or value to them, then you need to have the ability to choose otherwise. And so God cannot know those things, because if he knows them, then there's not a true either or value to them. And so therefore they're locked in. Right. And I think I use the kind of typical example. If I were to choose I'm wearing a blue shirt. If God knew that I would wear a blue shirt, then I couldn't have chosen a red shirt this morning. Even though there is a real decision there, I couldn't really finally have chosen a red shirt. And so they think that's a big issue. And so the BFM says, well, If you think that's an issue, that God knew the future decisions of free creatures, then you just can't affirm the BFM 2000. Another change that they made that I thought was helpful in 2000 is near the end of that opening paragraph, the eternal triune God reveals himself to us as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit with distinct personal attributes, but without division of nature, essence, or being. And I do think there are questions that people have about whether or not there's a modalistic flavor to the BFM. And again, these are critiques that we might wage against the BFM. Maybe it could be more explicit, but they didn't used to say eternal triune God reveals himself to us as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They said the eternal God reveals himself, I think, is the language. I have it pulled up. Let me.
Yeah, the eternal triune God.
But what they had in 63 was not that. It said the eternal God reveals himself to us as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, with distinct personal attributes, but without division of nature, essence, or being. Well, if he simply reveals himself to us as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, then of course that's vague enough that it ends up, well, is modalism a valid proposal within an SBC? And so they add the word triune right there, just plop it in there. He's eternally triune, and he therefore reveals himself as triune. Which follows very much a classic understanding of revelation and the economy. So here's some classic language. The economy reveals theology. And so as we see, the Son is sent by the Father and the Spirit by the Father and the Son. This reveals that the Son is of the Father and the Spirit is of the Father and the Son. And so there's an eternal begottenness that is revealed in the missions of the Father or of the Son and Spirit. So I think you can hold to classical theism fine while holding to the BFM. I split it up in the two ways that you mentioned, mostly because you've got to talk about the persons, the natures of Christ, the natures of the Son, and or else you're not really dealing with the issues of still confessing, right, of the creeds. And so I split that up into a separate chapter. But yeah, do you have any questions specifically?
Do you have anything, Ricky?
Not so much of a question, but definitely see how the importance of the culture around us sometimes dictates where we have to make those kind of statements. Because as you said, with open theism becoming more of a popular thing around this time, and even today we see it, and a lot of times, not in the SBC, but I've seen it in other Baptist circles where it's brought in and they don't even recognize that that's what's being taught. And so it's kind of things have been adapted. So here you're clarifying stuff to make sure that, hey, look, we understand that God knows all things. We understand that God is triune. These things to where you can't hold hands with someone who's modalistic or somebody who's, you know, a proponent of open theism.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think another point we can see here, and I know, kind of important, maybe even more attacked today, holding it to it that he has a substitutionary death, and not allowing, not saying that parts of Christus Victor isn't correct in how we see it, but that, you know, pushing that there is this substitutionary, which the Christus Victor comes out of a very liberal, kind of more liberal understanding as it's redeveloped with it. And I think, and that's, you can see here that the drafters of the BFM are thinking through these issues. There are what is classically held as the faith once delivered, as Dr. Moeller would say very often, and how do we fit in this with it? So, you know, I was kind of showing that this maybe might use different language as we kind of maybe pull away from some of maybe the more nuanced classical theism, you know, maybe immutability or something like that, and kind of some of those others that may be more debated today, but you still have a strong statement, you know, as you say, denying modalism and open theism and the other heresies that plagued the early church, where, you know, which came rise to that Nicene Creed, and having a full understanding of the deity of Christ and his person and all of that.
Exactly. So, just touching on the person of Christ issue. So near the end of the paragraph there, he ascended into heaven, and is now exalted at the right hand of God, where he is the one, he is the one mediator, fully God and fully man, in whose person is effected the reconciliation between God and man. That language of fully God and fully man, I think I make a little quibble the way that R.C. Sproul did a couple years ago with MacArthur on stage at Ligonier. But the idea, I think, behind, like, where did that language come from? Fully God, fully man. Richard Barcelos postulated this, so this is from him, not me. And I thought, yeah, that's intriguing, and maybe one day I'll look into it. But it could be that that language actually shows up in the wake of issues of canonic theories. So the canonic theory is simply that God the Son emptied himself, meaning that he divested himself of certain divine attributes. And by divesting himself of these divine attributes, that's how he becomes man. And the BFM and those that held the line on orthodoxy throughout the 19th and into the 20th century said, no, for him to empty himself is actually for him to add to himself a circumscribed nature, for him to add to himself a limited nature. But that doesn't mean that he ever took away anything of his infinite nature. And so he is now fully God and fully man, or even better, in the classical terms, would be truly God and truly man, truly being everything that is necessary to call a thing what it is attributable to the divine Son, and as God and as man. There you're pushing against canonic theories, certain canonic theories as well. You also see that here's another item that would need to be pressed into is Christ is the eternal Son of God. That just that simple statement, I don't think people recognize just how controversial that is in theological circles, because there are many following in the wake of, say, like somebody like Pannenberg, who would say that Jesus becomes the eternal Son of the eternal Son, and he's got a whole thing. It's really bizarre, but there are others that would say something very similar, where Jesus sort of becomes this exemplar correspondence to God, and this is really good Christology. Is all I'm saying. It's good Christology, and there have been a lot of challenges in the realm of Christology in all times, but especially in the last 100 years, 150 years.
So we'll move on to Article 8. It's on the Lord's Day. Kind of prefacing this, this is probably maybe it's more of a departure, but more because of how maybe wide the BFM takes it versus kind of the more narrow, some might say, or more particular view of the Sabbath in which or the Lord's Day, which the 1689 talks about it.
Yeah.
So can you like explain kind of maybe a little bit of the differences and maybe why the BFM tends to open it up?
Yeah. So when you look at the 1689, the 1689 is developed in the context of the Reformation and Reformed thought, and at least going back, you can go back as far as you want and you'll find a lot of talk about the Sabbath, but one instance would be even at the Synod of Dort. Robert Godfrey just came out with a book last year, maybe it was the year before, called Saving the Reformation. And in it, he offers his own fresh new translation of the Canons of Dort. And at the end, he also offers a translation of their counsel on how to observe the Sabbath, how to keep it holy. So right there at the Synod of Dort, they're dealing with the issue of the Sabbath and how to pastorally help their people obey the Sabbath. Of course, when you get to the Westminster, you have Puritans, and Puritans love the Sabbath. They delight in the Sabbath. They call the Sabbath a delight. And the 1689, the Baptists are in that world. They are part of the Christian Sabbath world. When you look at the New Hampshire Confession of Faith, it also talks about the Sabbath. Now, when you look at the abstract principles, and that might, it's not really something I'm going to get into, but it does change it and talk about it as the Lord's Day and Christian Sabbath. So this idea of Christian Sabbath kind of changes to just the Lord's Day. So 1689, we would say, understands the Decalogue to be the transcendent moral law in its expression. We want to take serious its covenantal position. It is given in the context of this Sinaitic covenant, but yet it's the transcendent moral law. And so all 10 of them come over into the new covenant, but they're transformed by Christ. And how are they transformed by Christ? Well, if you deny the Son, you do not have the Father. That's what 1 John tells us, right? And so you shall have no other gods before me means you better not be denying that Jesus is God the Son eternally and sent by the Father and all the rest. And so you can walk through each of the commandments while you also see the same with the transformation of the Sabbath into first day, Lord's Day Sabbath. Usually I call myself a Lord's Day Sabbatarian just to avoid the confusion, because others will call themselves Sabbatarian, and what they mean is they hold to the seventh day Sabbath. But we follow the example of the apostles who worshiped on the first day of the week, beginning on Resurrection Sunday, the following Sunday as well. There the Lord appears among them on the eighth day, on the following Sunday as well. And we just see regularly and consistently Lord's Day worship. So the BFM, though, I would say it doesn't depart per se. It departs in practice. Let's say it departs in practical departure. You can see a practical departure in Baptist life because of the fact that here's what it says. First day of the week, you're to worship. Okay, so you have to worship on the first day of the week. It commemorates the resurrection of Christ from the dead, includes exercises of worship and spiritual devotion, public and private. Activities on the Lord's Day should be commensurate with the Christian's conscience under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And so that language allows for both a Sabbatarian and a non-Sabbatarian to affirm the confession. And the reason why you would need to allow for non-Sabbatarians is because once you enter the 20th century, you end up with a lot of non-Sabbatarians within Baptist life anyways, and you have the rise of of arguments against what we would understand to be the right affirmation of the Sabbath. So both sides can agree with it, and notice it's commensurate with a Christian's conscience under the lordship of Christ. This means you don't get to decide. Jesus decides. Jesus binds your conscience, and he binds your conscience by his word. And so you obey the word. And I would say that would include the fourth commandment in a pretty univocal sense, in terms of the way it looked, the way it should have looked in the old covenant is very similar to how it should look in the new covenant as well. I say should because when you look at the Pharisees, so this is the response I get when people hear I'm a Sabbatarian. Oh, so you don't, and then they throw something out there that's like general relaxation on a Sunday, right? So you don't, yeah, you might, I've never been asked this, but you don't turn on your lights on Sunday? You know, you don't. What they're thinking of is Pharisaical understanding of the Sabbath. And why do I say that? Well, because Jesus rebukes the Pharisees for misunderstanding the Sabbath. I want to understand the Sabbath the way that Jesus understood the Sabbath, as a day set apart to give exclusive worship to the Lord and delight in all that he's done in creation and redemption, and especially in the redemption that is accomplished by Christ. So there are a lot of things on that list also, right? It should include exercises of worship and spiritual devotion, both public and private. Public and private. And how many non-Sabbatarians do you think actually follow that? Right. Yeah. So they'll wake up and they'll drag themselves to church, and then they'll head out to Applebee's or you know, most Applebee's are closed now, I think. head out to the campground and go fishing and you know, never think about the Lord again until next Sunday when they have to drag themselves to church again. That's not even in keeping with what we've got as our confessional basis.
He also included the mega churches to have a Saturday evening service.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's another SBC. Thing. I think, so here, if I want to get myself in hot water, there are churches in particular countries where the populace has Fridays off, and those churches will observe Friday as their worship, as their day of worship. And I would say that's outside of the BFM as well. You are to do it on the first day of the week, regardless of whether the culture does that as well or not. And the reason I would say that is because the apostles did it as well, and they were living in a culture that observed a seventh day of rest, right? And so they would still have worshiped on the first day as well. So if they could do it, we can do it too. And it might be hard. Yeah. And of course, the charge will be, well, you're sitting in comfortable Massachusetts and not in one of those countries. And yeah, the Lord is Lord of the conscience, right?
Yeah. And they would still have to work on the Sabbath, yeah. You know, so yeah. Even if you're, or on the first day. So they're on doing the
first day.
They're doing working and going to church, which we probably can't even fathom unless you have a job, kind of, to use the London Confession, you know, where you are doing means or
works of necessity,
works of necessity, where you have to maybe work, you get off shift and come to church to do it, you know, so yeah. You have that aspect with it.
Yeah, I think when people think of Sabbatarians, again, they think they've got the Pharisee as their paradigm, right? And so they think, oh, you're the guys that think you can't do X, Y, and Z. Yes, right? I mean, we do believe But on the seventh day, you shall not do any work, you or your male servant, your female servant, or the sojourners within your gates. Like, yeah, that is part of that commandment, but it is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. The idea is actually the positive aspect, which is this ought to be the desire of your heart is to spend this day in worship to God. And so, you know, works of necessity and mercy are accepted, but I would still want to say, like, you do desire to be with the people of God, worshiping God. You do desire to be in spending time in private and family devotions, secret and family devotions, and you know, communing with God, right? I'd still want to counsel them, and I'd want to say the same to somebody that's a non-Sabbatarian. You know, so you're doing these things, but are you really considering the fact that here you have an opportunity here in America where most employers are giving you Sundays off anyway, or would if you asked, right? This is a religious day for me. Can I have Sundays off? Many employers would. You know, have you asked? And have you asked so that you can spend time in communion with God? The idea isn't, okay, how many things can I check off the list that I didn't do? The idea is, did I actually devote my time to the Lord today and enjoy rest in his enthroned presence? So I think, you know, when you look at the seventh day in Genesis 2:1-3, you see the Lord resting. Well, what does it mean? Greg Beale says he's resting on his throne, right? So he's enthroned. And on the Sabbath, we come before that throne and delight in our King, right? That should be the heart. And we can talk about the other things too, and we should, but that should be the heart, I think.
Amen. But the Lord is our Sabbath rest, so therefore we can rest in Him any of those days. That's one of the arguments I usually hear. Yeah. I don't want to go down that rabbit trail.
That's convenient.
And I mentioned that in the book too. Yeah, I mentioned that in the book. You know, this when we say this is the Lord's day, we're not saying that the other days don't belong to the Lord either, right? And I don't mention this in the book, but the idea of Lord's Day, as it's brought into the New Testament, you can't leave aside the fact that it's also called the Lord's Day in the Old Testament. In Isaiah, it refers to the Sabbath as the Lord's Day, and so we just see that flower in the New Testament. Yeah.
So
we could go on, of course.
Go on. Yeah, we're getting close to, we're probably over an hour now. So we're going to look at Article 12 on education. Just thinking about it, because we mentioned it, it's not part of the Second London. So someone might, you know, want to ask, well, why does the BFM include something on education? Why do they need to kind of make a doctrinal stand on that?
Yeah, I think the most obvious reason is because of what the BFM is serving in terms of what it's doing in terms of its function. So its function is to serve as a confessional boundary for Southern Baptist churches. Well, Southern Baptist churches are just Baptists in a massive association. Right. So if you can picture a small association of churches, blow that up to 45,000 churches and you've got the SBC. And one of the things that Baptists have done is as we associate with one another, we also partner together in doing various things like missions and education. And those are the two big ones, right? We also, Baptists have historically also helped to support one another's churches when you need ministers. And you know, if our church is hurting financially, you might supply our need. If our church doesn't have a pastor or our pastor just is, we're not able to pay him, you might supply that as well. So our goal is as sister churches to act like sister churches, right? And so if we're going to have churches or if we're going to have schools that are supported by our big group of churches, then we need to have an understanding and agreement on what education is. And that, I mean, that's the most obvious reason why you would have an article on education. I could postulate all kinds of reasons why we don't have it in the 1689, but I'm not gonna speculate right now. Yeah. Not too much.
Maybe one thing is you don't have seminaries as we see them. They're not. I mean, you have Oxford and you have Cambridge, but those are not Baptist. And
that's right. Baptists can't go there, right? Yeah. There's a reason that you have that. John Gill stands out as an anomaly in a host of ways, but one of the main ways that he stands out as an anomaly is that he was so brilliant, having not gone to school after I think age 10 or something, and just being a better Hebrew scholar than anyone you know.
Yeah. And I think there's just a lot, you can pick into it. I think, thankfully, just the first sentence, Christianity is a faith of enlightenment and intelligence.
Yeah.
Obviously, this would push back against atheists who just believe Christians have this kind of sort of blind faith in it. And to really state that, no, we don't have a blind faith, that it is a faith that is enlightened, not maybe in the philosophical movement sense, but that we gain knowledge, that we become more, we know who God is. It's something we think about, and intelligence, that it's kind of not a blind faith. Even Paul talks about in dealing with the people of resurrection. Like, this is not just something theoretical that may happen. We have solid proof, and we see it in not only that Christ rose, but then there's also all these people who have seen him as he works through that.
Yeah. And so I open up that chapter with a host of prejudices that non-Christians might have against Christians. And, things like the fact, those people that believe in a 10,000 year old earth or less, or those people that are following this old book, those people that are that don't believe women have the ability to choose what to do with their bodies. You're saying those are the enlightened people? And I want to say yes, absolutely. We are the enlightened people, and we're the enlightened people in the sense that we've received the light, right? We have seen the light. The light is Christ. All those who deny Christ are those who walk in darkness. And really, it's those following in the wake of the enlightenment that are not enlightened. I think, and sort of getting to what you're saying, Mike, is there's the historic phrase, credo ut intelligam, right? I believe in order to understand. I believe so that I might understand. So I start with faith, but it's a faith seeking understanding, right? That's that's usually the same sentiment comes over, faith seeking understanding. I absolutely believe that Christ is the eternal Son who died for my sins and rose again and ascended on high and is coming again to judge us. And so I want to understand that deeply. He is the eternal Son of God, which means all things hold together in him, that God himself is the source of all true knowledge. And so all that he has revealed is what we should be seeking. And so that might mean in a theological sense, we're seeking his face in scripture, or in a natural sense, we're seeking the world. We're looking at the world that he has created in order to see him. You might look at the way that somebody like Augustine would have talked about usefulness. And so the things of nature are useful in the sense that we experience God through them. Our eyes don't end at them. If our eyes end at them, we're not using them the way that they were designed to be used. They were all designed to do what? To give glory to the God of heaven, as Psalm 19 tells us, right? The heavens declare the glory of God. And as soon as we start looking at the heavens and stop seen the glory of God. We've ceased to look at the heavens the way they were designed. And that's constraining, right? You have to, if that's the case, then anything that leads you away from Christ is something that leads you away from true knowledge.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, I just had a conversation with a professing atheist today, and that's one of the things that they threw out. Well, you just have this faith, faith, faith. You know, they even did the George Michael song. You got to have faith, 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 you know, kind of in a mocking way. And said, well, I believe in science. And I said, well, which science are you appealing to? Historical science, or are you appealing to the scientific method? And they ran from the conversation from that point, because either they didn't understand, because I was trying to reason with them. Like, are you looking at historical science that just gives you an observation, just like we would say with the historical faith that we have, or something that's observable? Because most of the times when it comes to evolution in that sense, it's not observable. So they're not really appealing to the scientific method. But sometimes, again, you're trying to think these things through. It's not just a faith that's without knowledge. As you said, you believe it by faith, and then you're reasoning through these things and getting more understanding as the Spirit's moving within you, helping you to discern these things. So, Mike, I don't know, because we're definitely over a little bit. If you want to go a little bit longer, that's fine. If he has the time, and or if you're ready to wrap things up, let me know.
Yeah, I'm ready. For those who are listening, the book we were talking about, Still Confessing, it's printed by Founders Press. There's a link in the YouTube description. We'll try to get one on the audio podcast too. To Founders to order it. And also, we also have Daniel's blog in there. If you want to just to read some of his thoughts on different things, they're always very insightful. With that, he's also on Twitter, and I recommend following him. He's usually posting Gill quotes.
Augustine.
Yeah, kind of whatever. He's usually probably reading for sermons.
I read for all kinds of things.
They're always a good... So if you want something more refreshing on Twitter, you can follow him there on Twitter too. I would recommend that. He also has a couple articles, probably one you just posted from Westminster. If you want to see other things he likes to talk about, he posted an article he wrote and delivered in England, but kind of talking about Baptist Covenant, 1689 Federalism, maybe kind of put it that way, and Progressive Covenantism and their relationship in hermeneutics. Those who want to, you hear these terms, you're like, man, what's the difference? Like, what's the difference between like Baptist Covenant theology and Progressive and New Covenant? This would be one article to help you at least on a foundational, because how we understand the Bible, how we study it, hermeneutics affects how we affects the conclusions we come from it. So that would be a good article. A more recent one on some of his other interests. He has interest in both systematic and historical theology, so go read his blog post and you'll very quickly find useful information about that. You have any final comments as we close out the show?
Not that I can think of. I can talk all night. It's probably best that you cut me off at some point. That's the best way to go about it.
Yeah, since we don't have our wives here to do that.
That's right. My wife will usually help me know when I've reached my limits.
All right, that's been G220 Radio then for tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. Again, as Mike said, you can check out the show notes and get some information there. We will be giving one of the copies of this book away. So if you would share this episode, hashtag G220 Radio, either on Twitter or on Facebook there, and we'll be able to track that, and then we will come up with a way of choosing those who are sharing this and have a winner there, and we will get you a book out to you. Again, that's been G220 Radio. Until next time, God bless and good night.